There are secrets out there, guys. Performance marketing secrets, and knowing just one or two of them can absolutely light up your funnels. Let's go. This is the Revenue Driven CMO. I'm your host, Chris McKinnick. Join me as I uncover the secrets of the world's most elite CMOs marketing leaders. The Revenue Driven CMO is sponsored by Web Mechanics, the AI-driven performance agency that makes you smarter. What has one of your biggest success secrets been?
I would say I've always kind of led with a contrarian view in everything that I've done. And I think a lot of that has really been attributed to a few things. One being a little bit naive enough to not know what you don't know and not let that hinder your ability to think differently. And an example of that is at ClickUp, you know, I was coming into SaaS for the first time after being on the consumer marketing side for most of my career. And I really believed that we could take a different approach. And instead of all of the other enterprise SaaS companies really treating it like we have to market to this enterprise buyer in this very masculine, static, serious way, that we could add humor and we could add a humanization approach to it that most companies didn't take. And, you know, that was sort of a big bet. It was, hey, how do we, you know, we're going to treat the enterprise buyer like we're going to treat a self-serve buyer, and everyone is going to ladder up to this same holistic brand. And from there, we're going to build out our narratives and you know, customize certain pieces of our collateral and of our marketing materials. But holistically, our brand would be more consumer than it would feel B2B.
Yeah. Yeah. And interesting. So you chalk it up in a way to naivety and, you know, not knowing what you don't know. Well, for everybody listening, you should totally check out ClickUp's ads on YouTube. They're hilarious. Like the Jira exit interview one I saw. Yeah. That was super funny.
Yeah. Yeah.
What is your approach? Like when you sit down and you say, hey, whether taking a stab at a competitor or not, like what is your approach to making humorous ads?
Yeah. I mean, it's very thoughtful because I think there's two layers of being humorous. There's what you internally think is funny and then what other people actually think is funny. And I think there's such a fine line between the two where you're marketing for yourself or you're marketing for your actual customers and to the narratives that people are already speaking to. Yeah. So I've learned to really toe that fine line. I think, you know, we've all seen ads, we've all seen, you know, content where we're like, wow, how did that get approved? Right. Like, you know, who thought that this was a good idea? And I didn't want to really be on that side of history. So it's always a thoughtful approach of, how do we do this? Is this okay? Like, you know, for Jira, for example, who do we want to go up against? It didn't make sense to really go up against, you know, there are several competitors in our category that we could have punched up against. And that was one of the big first things we wanted to do, which was punch up. And, you know, Atlassian is a $50 billion market cap company. Figured they could take the heat a bit. That was, you know, the second piece of it. And the other side of it was the fact that we knew we could create a narrative that was already a narrative in market. If you looked at the, you know, frustration of people that were actually using Jira, it's always become mainstream, a meme of sorts, where you read it on Reddit or you read, you know, there are memes going around, you know, like, we can fix this, but we can't fix Jira. So kind of knowing that that was already this mainstream conversation happening, it was easier to play off of because we knew people would receive it well. And also, you know, we were really thoughtful about the framework of how we positioned it. We knew it would be polarizing no matter what, but we knew that if we took a very almost SNL humorous approach, it wouldn't feel like a political ad campaign where we were just smearing our competitor. It's a thoughtful, clever, funny, creative approach and a framework that people are already familiar with a problem that we already know that they're dealing with. We're not making that problem up. So it seems like an easy thing, but you have to go through all these steps to really understand if this is going to come out well, is this going to come across well? So when, you know, that's just kind of like a microcosm into the world of how I think about ideas and what ideas are good and what ideas should be shelved.
Yeah. So smart to like latch on to a conversation that's already happening.
Yes.
Super duper smart. So, it was interesting what you said about like the difference between what you think is funny and what other people will think is funny. How do you like test that before you go through the effort of making an ad or a campaign or, you know, putting it in market? Like, is there a toe dip approach that you use?
Yeah. I mean, it depends on the, like how high risk we think it is. You know, if it's something that's pretty tame that we know will come off well, we just kind of ship it. You know, at this point, it's we trust ourselves. We trust what, you know, historically we've been able to put out. But if we are nervous, we'll go through a tool like user testing, or we'll do something to actually gauge, you know, reception and take that with a grain of salt, but understand like, hey, you know, 5% of people aren't going to think this is funny. But like, if it's more than that, like, we, you know, maybe we should kind of either change it or tweak it or kill it. But, you know, for the most part, you know, our narratives are driven by, and I think this is what makes us special, are driven by the real problems that people are having in the world of work. And they speak to things that are already happening rather than creating these fake issues. And I think that's like, that really is the secret sauce to being able to connect with people through emotion, through like, oh, did you see this? This is, we were talking about this the other day. When people are already having the conversations, it's easier than creating, you know, a fake ad campaign of a problem that doesn't exist and a made up word, which you see a lot, right? And that's just not our approach to it. It's like, let's do it through the things that the people that are going to use our software or actually struggling with, and do that humorously.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Now, as a newcomer to the B2B space, you will find, as you probably have, that a lot of the content, a lot of the messaging is just boring, right? Yeah. It's like very sanitized. It's just incredibly boring. It sounds like your style is like just naturally humanizing. So like, no matter where you landed, you probably would have humanized. Is humor, like, in other words, like, let's say that you were a consultant for many brands, would your approach be like humanized and tasteful humor generally across the board? Or do you think it's applicable to pretty much like all B2B brands? Or do you think there's certain B2B brands that like couldn't or shouldn't even try to pull it off?
That's a good question. For the most part, I think humor can be done. And I think it's the most effective form of marketing when it's done well.
Because so fun. Yeah, so effective.
You can still convey all you want to convey that are the, you know, value prop of what you're actually selling through humor. Like it's not this one or the other, like either it's through value, you know, you're selling features, you're selling value, or you're doing it through humor. Like, and I think for a very long time, people believed that these things couldn't coexist within, you know, the holistic way that a company is marketed. So I truly believe that like when you distill it down, you know, it has to be authentic to like who the brand is and how they approach themselves, again, through all of the touch points. It can, but I really do believe that that's it is a way forward for most B2B brands. Now, I think it doesn't seem disingenuous or weird if a brand like kind of comes out with one ad campaign that's funny and then like everything else like doesn't feel like that. A little bit. I think like, you know, you have to kind of own it and approach things either, you know, not everything needs to be laugh out loud funny, but it needs to have a tweak and a hint of that. We get you. We understand you level of self-awareness. And that can be in email marketing copy and sequences. It could be in white papers. It can be in, you know, it's tone. And it's a making sure that tone is applied throughout everything that you do, even if it's a slight wink every once in a while.
Yeah. You know, there's another brand and a CMO that was on the pod. I can introduce you if you want, but it was Data Rails. Okay. They're an Israeli company, but I'll share their link, their LinkedIn post, but it's like hilarious. Like they take basically like memes or, you know, like the little, it's a meme, but it's like a video meme where it'll show like 10 people digging a hole, and then like the boss is like standing over watching, and it points to the people digging and it's like, these are the developers. And then it points to the boss and it's like, this is the project manager.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I like, but use of memes is always, you know, like it's still like, it doesn't matter. You can be an enterprise security company. It, like there are ways to relate, you know, these like conceptual things that are all very like, just already easily understandable. And then
yeah.
Through the problems that your company is solving or through that engineer. So I love that. I think that's a great approach.
Yeah, they're called Data Rails. I'll share you on their thing and I can intro you if you want. But
awesome.
So I think you're brilliant. I'm really, really impressed by you. The audience is going to love listening to this. In your experience at Dropbox and at Amplitude so far, where you were really getting a master's degree in PLG. For all PLG marketers listening right now, like, can you think of any lessons that you learned at Dropbox that were unique or extraordinary, or things that like you don't necessarily read in any blog posts that you might stumble into regarding PLG?
What I discovered and was part of the power of PLG is the magic ratio called LTV to CAC. Lifetime value divided by cost of acquisition, which to me was also very transformational, because you start looking at the entire marketing engine from that lens and you start really assessing the efficiency of your channels, efficiency of your campaigns from that lens, which is very close to the language of product teams as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's really something that was, in my view, game changing. And it allows you to manage your marketing budget, your marketing programs in a completely different way. It's very performance driven, mm-hmm. and it's a very quite simple binary element. Is the ratio profitable for you or not? And
yeah.
It actually changes your perspective, right, on the role of marketing. Whereas if you are purely working for an enterprise driven company where you are an influencer to pipeline and revenue, you don't feel necessarily that tension, that pressure between revenue growth and those ratios. But when you are working on PLG, it's every day. Every day you're gonna check all of the performance of your channels. You're gonna have to just really apply that discipline, and it's very dynamic. The reason it's every day is because the online business happens in the moment, so you have to constantly think about that, on a daily, weekly, monthly, quarterly basis.
Yeah. So whereas in a non-PLG environment, you might launch a campaign and be like, this is great. We spent $1,000 and got 100 leads. Like, let's add budget there. In a PLG led environment, you might launch that very same campaign, but not really get excited about it or unexcited about it until the point where the 14-day free trial is over and you see like what percentage of those leads you were able to convert to paying customers.
Yeah, but don't get me wrong. This LTV to CAC ratio has to apply to every single motion that you have. So you have to be able to really look into it in its entirety. I think that what's exciting about PLG is the speed at which you operate. You have to constantly optimize your channels, your programs, your performance. You have to do it in the product. You have to do it outside of the product. You need to have those elements extremely well sequenced. But if you run an LTV to CAC model also for the more high-touch segments, high-touch programs, you're going to have that same mindset. You're going to have to start thinking about efficiency long-term, value of your customer, and it's going to help you really rationalize the way you invest and the way you think about your tactics and your programs very differently. But it is true that there are some significant differences between a sales-led motion and programmatic strategy from a marketing standpoint than there is with PLG. But I would say that a lot of companies now are starting to really think about how they digitize their business. And when they do so, they're starting to think about how they digitize their product. And when you start thinking about a digital product, you have to start to apply some of the principles of a product-led growth strategy. So that's what's really exciting to me. And we're starting to see it happen because admittedly, PLG has existed for a long time. A lot of the e-commerce companies have used the concepts of product-led growth quite a long time, especially in the media, but also in retail, online retail and others. There's been an explosion of these. But think about traditional companies. I'm going to give you a real example.
Okay.
Think about how traditional companies are now starting to embrace product as a source of revenue for them and how they're starting to really create a varied mix of products, either physical products or digital products. The example I have is regarding the brand Fender. We know Fender as being a guitar company. It's very well known. They deliver exceptionally amazing products. Who doesn't know Fender? Everybody does know. But who knows, for example, that Fender has created an app called Fender Play, which offers actually bite-sized lessons for beginner and intermediate guitar players.
Mm-hmm.
So is this Fender Play a digital product? 100% it is. Because what they do when they actually offer this online app, it helps them actually influence the real purchase of their real physical product, which is a guitar. Their assumption and their hypothesis when they started creating this digital model was, if we teach people to play and to learn and play the guitar, they'll want to come back for more. They'll be interested. They will advocate for the brand and they will get hooked into it. And then over time, they're going to improve and hopefully buy more. So there was a direct correlation between that digital product, which is an online tutorial app, and the actual physical product, which is a guitar. And they can have both. So imagine the business opportunity for Fender. And this is just one example, but many can happen also in the quick service restaurants we see in. We're working with great brands like Chick-fil-A. Same logic here. Physical product to sell, but digital product that supports their physical product strategy, and so forth and so on. We work with a lot of retail brands who are also starting to diversify their digital strategy and experience, Walmart being one of our key customers, and mm-hmm. so forth and so on. Media companies are doing it, of course. So what's exciting about this is that product, the digital product, is at the core of the transformation of companies.
Yeah.
And those companies are starting to think along the lines of the way I've explained how marketing is starting to think about its own mission, its own role, and the way they really help influence, support, or directly run growth and revenue for companies.
Yeah, no, I love it. And hey, exclusive for listeners of this podcast, Web Mechanics will do 10 to 20 hours of work for you for free. Literally no sales calls, no BS. Just give them a problem and they will put a team to work for you for free for 10 to 20 hours, even if you're already a client. If you're struggling with demand gen, lead gen, SEO, SEM, Google Ads, LinkedIn Ads, conversion optimization, if you can't get Facebook or Meta Ads to work for the life of you, or you can't figure out attribution, Web Mechanics will take a good hard look at whatever problem you give them, whatever programs you put in front of them, and they will give you an objective, informed opinion, plus some advice from 10 to 20 hours of senior level attention. So I would suggest take them up on this offer. It's ridiculous. Go to revenuedrivencmo.com/free, fill out the 2-minute form, and you will not regret it. Literally zero downside, unlimited potential for growth. So do yourself a favor, revenuedrivencmo.com/free, no hyphens, no punctuations. You will be happy about that decision. So like, what advice would you give to a leader that's got a team that is, you know, leaning toward this side? They could very well be talented. You know, maybe they are skilled in direct response, but they're not functioning like they should. What advice would you give them to sort of like shift them over to the high impact side of the equation?
Yeah, great question. It really boils down to two things. Do you have the right people in the right seats?
Yep.
If yes, then do they have the right rhythm established in the team? And I'm talking about the royal team of marketers, analysts, data scientists, creatives, that establishes a heartbeat, gives everybody this like unified sense of forward without suffocating them. Creatives in particular, just it's highly emergent work. It's highly volatile work. So you can't always shove it through a meat grinder and have it pop out a sausage. You have to give it space. But not so much space that, you know, you're off in this ethereal land. So I think it boils down to those two things. And so I'll deep dive a little bit on, okay, evaluating who's on staff, making sure the right people are in the right seats. That sounds great, Jill. How do you do that really tactically? And I've done this a few times. I've been called in to different roles specifically for this reason, to come in, evaluate teams, make changes in smart, strategic ways. You don't want to just always keep things how it is. You don't always want to blow up the situation. That's not what we're after here. We're trying to be really smart and surgical. And that really, what it really boils down to is, one, spend time observing the team as a whole. Observe the positive and negative dynamics between the different folks. Also, spend time individually with each person. Really get to know them. What makes them tick? What makes them wilt? What motivates them in career? I think with creatives, I've found purpose and meaning, and does my work go live and have some kind of impact? Like, means more than some more traditional factors that you would think about some of these roles.
Yeah,
you got to get curious and become an investigator. I mean, at the end of the day, like, you need to make this your job for 3 weeks, 3 to 4 weeks.
Okay.
And then as you do that, so you're observing, you're taking notes, you're really looking at the dynamic of the whole, you're looking at the parts and the individuals. And I really, you know, this includes designers, writers, ops folks, anyone who's like really engaged in the creative process. You really need to evaluate the whole system. It's not just pull the designers aside and have this kind of focus. It's really everybody.
Yeah.
And when you take 4 huge steps back after all your observations, you need to evaluate each person against 6 competencies. And these are the 6 that I've found to be true in most cases. There are some caveats, I'm sure. And you can have some one-offs that are outliers that don't fall within these competencies. But if you can identify folks that have these 6 competencies and then make sure they're in the right level and role, you'll be in a great spot. And the first one is curiosity. This probably comes as no surprise. There's a really great Forbes article about curious people. And, you know, how I evaluate this is I just sit down and ask them if they're, you know, what their hobbies are, if they're learning anything new, whether that's for work or personal, or maybe they're like, man, I'm trying my first DIY project, whatever it is, getting really curious. How's it going? If they, you know, take an interest, see where they're hitting snags, see what they're learning about. What are they learning about the topic? What are they learning about themselves? You know, the Forbes article says, you know, a great interview question is, tell me something you've taught yourself in the last 6 months. How did you teach yourself this skill or idea? And what was the result? Sometimes it's a bad result. That's awesome. We're not looking for perfection. We're looking for, like, are these people interested in things and in learning and being just genuinely curious about problems that they're trying to solve?
Okay, love that. So curiosity, and we've got those questions like, hey, what are your hobbies? What are you learning? What have you taught yourself? Love that. So what's competency two? You could write a book, by the way, on this. I love this.
Maybe that'll be my next thing. Number two is discipline problem solving. This one is my favorite one to do to a team, I'll be honest. And it is something that I do to teams. It's not something that is more, you know, subtle than that. What I love to do is give them a really vague prompt and a time box. Okay. So, and see what they do, see how they organize, see who really is the natural leader when you strip people of the day-to-day titles and roles and rhythms that are there. You like really light the ground on fire and you learn some cool stuff. I walked into a team at one point, and this team, you know, said, man, they really like working on like big creative problems. And they feel like they're working on small creative problems. I'm like, awesome. I'm going to take you guys offline for 2 weeks. That's pretty extreme. But I mean, to give them a big creative problem to solve, you've got to give them some big space. So this was kind of a special situation where I had the support of my CEO and others to do this exercise. And I gave them the prompt of how do we build trust in a brand, in our brand? We were a young brand. We were an untrusted brand. We had some really interesting Google results of, is this company legit? Mm-hmm. And I gave them, I was like, you've got 2 weeks to concept and really think about how are we going to move the needle on what we're calling trust in this brand? How would you measure that? How do you think about it? I didn't involve marketers. I just set them free. And what came back was 72 different concepts. It was crazy. And some of them were great and some of them were outright terrible. And then everything in between. And then you give them the prompt, okay, if you were CEO, narrow it down to three, you know? Can you do that? So you're really seeing, can they diverge? Can they think big and go wide and come up with options? And then can they decide? Can they converge and come back together? That's mm-hmm. discipline problem solving. And not all creative teams can do it. Some creative teams, to your point, will say, well, where's my 15-page brief? And that would be the end of the conversation.
Yeah, 100%. No, I love that one. Give a vague prompt and a timeline.
Yeah, that's very important.
Yeah, and the how do we build trust in the brand is a great one. I also like the idea, like from the observatory phase, just like seeing who rises as the natural leader. That's really interesting.
Yeah, because sometimes it's not the creative director. Sometimes it's a junior level creative who just gets it, and that's okay. And I'm not saying that you don't need the creative director, but what I am saying is, man, harness that. Make sure they're in the right seat. Make sure that when you go into the part two of establishing the rhythm, that it's a rhythm that helps raise the bar for the people who really are your all-stars. It's really important.
Yeah. No, that was a unique concept too. So we've got two of the six. We've got curiosity, discipline, problem solving. This is where you're looking for, I suppose, from individuals as well as the team as a whole.
Yeah.
What's number three?
Systems thinking.
Okay. I like that.
So I have run into many creative teams who you hand them a brief and they hand you back an ad, one ad. They're like, well, you asked for a billboard. Here's your billboard. I'm like, well, let's think a little bit broader. Let's think how this might work within our total system. How does it work within our total communication system, right? How am I to be sure, right, if I'm getting one of something, that this is really the right way to go? And again, the way to really open the door to the right conversations around A-B testing, variations, getting to performant creative, across different channels is, man, really facilitating the way that they think about systems. Mm-hmm. I've done this a few different ways. One of my favorite, it's pretty straightforward, is you do a quick brief. It can be on any project. It can be a project in your current workflow. It's not one where you have to take people offline. And ask them to provide options. And just leave it at that. Can you
ask them to provide what now? Sorry.
Options.
Oh, options. Okay.
And observe how they structure their options naturally. Ask them why they provided these options. What was their thinking? We'll see how they're thinking through that problem. Then when it comes time to revision, introduce a framework. So a framework that I like to introduce is what's called the limbic map. And, you know, humans make decisions with the limbic part of their brain, right? We're just little lizards running around at the end of the day. And then we defend those decisions rationally with our frontal cortex. And so the limbic map really shows, you know, that when you're in that limbic part of your brain, when you're making these buying decisions, you're seeking stimulation, dominance, or balance. And so I love giving this framework to creatives, like, hey, help me if there's someone that I'm trying to activate their stimulant, you know, part of their brain. How would you take these options that you just gave me and push those towards that? How would you push them towards dominance? How would you push them towards balance? And good news, if you've got curious people, they're going to scratch their head and be like, that's a great question. So you also kind of get another dose of, hey, is this person curious? But then creatives who work in systems will end up with something that looks like a weird grid of stuff. You know, here was the original ad. Here's how I pushed it three different ways. And here's the rationale for why I believe this pushes this ad towards this limbic area or another. Or they'll create some kind of really well-organized presentation of some sort. So that's really what you're looking for. But that's a favorite, exercise I love to introduce. And I like the limbic map because it's pretty visceral. You don't have to explain it too much. When you really look at the image of the limbic map, if you just Google it, you'll see it. You're like, oh, okay, this makes sense to me. So it's not something you've spent a lot of time educating a creative on.
Right. Love it. So curiosity, discipline, problem solving, systems thinking, and then number four.
This is a big one. Ability to disagree and commit.
Disagree and commit. I love that. Where'd you learn this? You just make this up?
Yeah. Well, disagree and commit. No. Gosh.
I love this.
From a book. I'm blanking on what book. I'll have to look it up and send
it to you.
That's all right.
But no problem.
Disagree and commit is the value, or I guess what the competency that I personally care about the most. I've worked on teams and I've observed so many teams, and you talk to them about, man, tell me about your best and worst project. And there will always be these people, or I shouldn't say always, but some people will still talk about that one time when they were right and nobody listened and nobody listens to me and it sucks the life out of a team, especially if you have too many of those going on.
Mm-hmm.
And so to test this out, and to see if your teams have the ability to commit, what I do is I figure out what they're going to disagree with, frankly. I learn about them. I go through a project. I'm like, ooh, okay, they really disagree here. Great. And then they kind of disagree here. And I might try some different subtleties within it. And I say, hey, we're going to make this decision. It's my decision to make. I'm going to make it. I understand and I hear you that you totally disagree with this. You've made some really valid points. Are you able to commit to this? And some people will flat out say no. It is fascinating to see that. And if they say no, ask why. Figure out why. Like, maybe they really do have a compelling reason. But at the end of the day, we need to find something that we can use to see if they truly can disagree and commit. Bonus points, if you can come back and tell them it failed and see how they respond. So this is where I will admit, and anyone on my existing teams, I apologize if you didn't know that I did this already. Sometimes I will tell a fib and tell them something failed. just to see what the response is. Even if the creative worked, or even if whatever it was that we were disagreeing and committing on did create a desirable result, sometimes just to see, I will, you know, and again, this is just in the evaluation phase. I do not pull these punches on the day-to-day. That would be wholly unfair.
Yeah.
But I'll tell them, hey, it failed. And I'll ask them, what do you think we should do next? And if they snap right back to, you should just listen to me. You should do the thing that I said. Versus get curious, well, what failed? What do you mean? Is there anything, let's think about maybe what we did explore. Or, yeah, that thing I brought up, maybe that could help, but I don't know. Maybe would you be open to testing that? Like, that's a much healthier conversation. If it turns into accusatory, you should have listened to me. I knew it. There's something to coach on there. There's a big thing to coach on there, because again, this is one of those competencies that is such an ordinary skill that is extraordinarily painful if to business if it's not being exhibited.
Yeah, no, 100%, 100%. We've got a framework here. So it's agreed or aligned, right?
Yeah.
So for an unpopular decision, agreed means like 100%, I agree, and we're moving. Aligned just means like, I don't love it, but I'll do it.
Yeah, exactly. And if we align, we're going to move forward as a team. And even if it fails, we'll solve it together. We're not going to blame and point fingers. That's awesome. Mm-hmm. I like that phrasing of it too.
Yep. Cool. Thank you. All right. So we are into number five at this point, and I'll recap all of them at the end.
Yeah.
So what's number five?
Number five is they want to come to the analytics meeting. Really, number five is outcome orientation, right? They are interested in the outcomes. To your point, I mean, you mentioned this earlier, they understand the platform. They understand what we're trying to drive. Like, they're intimate with the outcomes of the business. So outcome orientation is the fifth competency. And again, that could look like wanting to come to the analytics meeting. They like to hear when their A-B tests fail. It's not a wound to their soul. It's a, oh man, what happened? That's really neat. Right? They're interested in those outcomes.
100%. Yep. Okay. I love that one. I like that, aren't a wound to their soul.
Yeah.
All right. And then what's number six?
Last one's pretty simple. Positive dynamics. This one really boils down to what you observe when you look at the team as a group. You will naturally find people who, as they engage with others, can create more positive dynamics. And you'll find folks that as they engage with others, just the energy in the room goes down. This one's much more touchy-feely. It's definitely, there's a reason why it's number six on the list. But it is important just to recognize, man, there are instances, and sometimes it's multiple people who, like, man, these two people are great individuals. But when they get together, it's like they melt down. They cannot produce a compelling product. That's important. That's really important to know.
100%. So let me recap here. I love this framework. So what you're going to do when you are deciding or determining the, I'll call it the alchemy of your team, like how well they're working together, whether they're putting their best work out, you're looking at who's on staff. You're not doing an overhaul, right? You're going to be really smart and surgical, but you're going to take a few weeks, spend time observing that team as a whole. How are they interacting? How are they engaging? Spend time also individually with each person. What really makes them tick? And what motivates them, right? You want to be kind of have your curiosity hat on, like you're an investigator here. And that, say, spend some time, spend a few weeks, 3-4 weeks doing that. And it's not just with designers, it's with your, you know, with your writers, your editors, your operations folks. Take that step back. And then once you've done that observation, then you take 4 huge steps back and you look at 6 different dimensions or 6 competencies. Curiosity. How curious are people? disciplined problem solving. And I love the vague prompt example. Systems thinking is number three. Disagree, the ability to disagree and commit is number four. Outcome orientation, being curious and interested in the data is number five. And then positive dynamics. It's just like, are they working together well? Are they getting things done and putting out great work? I love it, Jill. That's a really useful framework. I'm very impressed by that. After many, many years as a leader on the sales side, on the marketing side, and amazing success, what would you say is one of your best kept secrets to success in marketing and sales and life?
Well, a little giveaway in how you introduced me, but I believe it's generosity. And I think generosity pays dividends if you lean into it. And generosity might initially feel like something that you're contributing or paying towards. And I believe that generosity shows up in a lot of different ways. And let me just break down maybe four of those. So generosity might show up in resources. So what you have available to you and how are you using that to benefit others? It might show up with your time. Time is really precious. So when you're committing time to projects, to people, to those things, that goes a long way in being generous. It might show up with how you share your expertise and being generous with your knowledge, being generous with sharing that and not keeping all that knowledge to yourself.
Yeah.
And generosity shows up with how you celebrate and appreciate others, like really taking the time to be generous with letting your team members know they matter, putting time into and celebration and appreciation for just the people in your life. And I believe when all that comes together, you can be generous in both your business and in your life. And those are things that truly pay dividends.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, that last one that you said in terms of celebrating, that's one that for me, I could really take a page out of that book. I think I'm the type of leader I probably don't recognize with kind words enough. And I do it almost intentionally just so that when I do recognize with kind words, it means a lot. But I should be more generous with that, you know, like even maybe not like overly generous so that it's just like, hey, Chris is going to compliment me no matter what I do. But some kind words, some kind, genuine words go a really long way with people. And while it's generous, you know, it's very inexpensive. Like it costs nothing, takes almost no time. So I really love, you know, the being generous with celebration. Then being, to recap, so four ways to that generosity shows up in being generous with resources, being generous with time, being generous with knowledge, and being generous with celebration and kind words. So that is an awesome framework in a world where all of those things are stretched, right? Especially definitely. Resources and time. It is definitely a different and sort of contrarian take. How has this benefited you in your career? Like, can you think of any specific stories where like you were generous selflessly and then it turned around to pay dividends?
Yes, I'd love to share with you kind of what opened the door to my current role that I have. So I was at the company and I was doing on the sales side. I was recruiting, growing branches at our footprint in new states and over kind of that day-to-day of doing the mortgage business. And I went into a meeting and the leader of our company, it was an advisory meeting. So we bring in, we have an advisory board of our own employees. And we were meeting with them and he presented and handed out all these new logos. And he said, we've decided that we want to re-logo the company, rebrand the company. And here's some that we've come up with. Why don't you guys vote? I've never seen it. Didn't have anything to do with it at the time. And I'm looking at these saying, this cannot be what we do. I have some expertise in branding. I had my own company for a long time. And I just have been through the branding process. And I was like,
I don't think they have it right. They're not doing the full scope of it. They're going to miss the mark on this. So I went in to his office and did my pitch and said, please let me have a shot at it. Let me take that on and give you what you're looking for. Get a better brand that represents who we are, that represents where we're trying to go. We had some big strategies for this. And so through that process, I took it on. I already had a job. I already had plenty to do and a role, but I just felt like I had this expertise that I could lean in. And I had some resources that I could pull on to help me kind of shape this and pull it together with the team. And we put together what is currently the brand of American Pacific Mortgage. So we went through a full brand rework and delivered back something that I'm really proud of that we did. And that opened an opportunity for me to then take on additional marketing roles. And then it eventually became, you know, CMO of the company. So wow. I found that when you're generous, that's how doors get open. That's how you get opportunities in your career. If you've got an idea or a passion for something, lean into that. Don't be afraid of that. That's not your job. And you just don't know what doors might, you know, open for your career.
Wow. So being generous in a way where you were like, hey, don't make this mistake. Let me help you. Literally led to your career. Like it literally, and it doesn't sound like you asked for a promotion. It doesn't sound like you asked for more, but it just like serendipitously led to more.
Yeah. I just, I knew I could help. And so I took it through the rebrand, presented it back. They loved it. So then I did the whole implementation of the brand. So I'm doing this at the same time I'm doing my other role. And then with time, I just said, I want to keep this. Can I keep marketing and what I'm doing? And then it got to a point where it was like, okay, I'll just do the marketing side. Other people can do the sales and production of the day-to-day of kind of how we're bringing in. So I could really lean in. And then we wrote a strategy. I mean, a goal for the company was, how do we bring widespread awareness of American Pacific Mortgage to the marketplace? Because our brand wasn't well known. We were pretty good size, but we weren't well known. So then that became, we went into our, you know, our annual strategic planning meeting and we were setting goals. And I'm like, I want to take that one. I want to take bringing widespread awareness of the brand. And so then I became that goal owner and then built out strategies. And then it kind of just evolved over time. But it's been really fun to like start there and then, you know, craft it into something that's really great and fun.
Yeah, no, I love the brand. It's very well done. I love the typography. And from the homepage, the We Bring People Home, that's a really strong tagline.
Thank you.
And I love the image in the back. Like it doesn't look like stock, like it doesn't look like a stock photo. I don't know if it is or not, but it certainly looks like a genuine and original photography. All the photography around the site looks really nice. So very, very well done. But I think, Melissa, you know, there is probably a deeper level to this in terms of generosity. Copywriters, like people that write, you know, direct response copy, one of their tenets, so they have different tenets such as scarcity, urgency, you know, benefits over features, things like that. But one of them that I've heard about is the law of reciprocity. So when you do something that is authentically generous, the receiver of that generosity almost can't help but to want to reciprocate and to want to do something generous and nice for you. So it works in marketing. Like if, you know, if your offer is such that it's just like so high value, then, you know, the downloader of that content or the consumer, you know, of that offer is like, wow, this was amazing. This was free. I can't believe that. And so they feel compelled to take the next steps. But it turns out it works in life too.
Definitely. I mean, that's what's so fun to talk about is it's just not a common thing that is discussed. But if you pause and look back at your life or times that you've had this generosity, it is both ways, like you said. I mean, my goal would be, is there a way that just bringing more awareness to generosity that people can grab onto one thing that they can like, oh yeah, I could do that better. Oh yeah, that is a way I can be generous, and kind of just more community, more connections. I love talking about how you're experienced, how people experience you, and you might be you as a person, you might be you as a company, but like how are you experienced? And what is the one-to-one experience? What's the online experience? People that don't know you, people that know you, and how do you want them to feel? And so I kind of let that fuel marketing as well as just showing up as a leader and showing up for my team and for my company. It's, I'm always kind of like going back to that, like, how are they experiencing you? And there's like a bunch of strategies of how you can do that, but just keeping it top of mind. So life is hard and work is hard and there's always that grind to it all. But I also feel like you can show up really well and make the time matter when you're there. And so I love talking about all of this stuff because I really think we all want to have purpose and we all want to know that our work has some impact and that the things that we do not only help hit, you know, revenue and sales goals or income goals, but also on the people side, the humanity side, that we can show and have some impact. And I believe just being generous with different areas. You can be generous with your energy. That might be another way that you want to be generous. It's just being generous with being present. And, you know, the list goes on and on of all the ways that that you can be generous, that I just think it shows up in life and business. And in business, that was the big moment of leaning in and taking the logo and the rebrand. That was a big moment to be generous because I already had a job and now I'm taking on a pretty big, massive project that wasn't mine.
Yeah.
Generosity in life looks like I'm going to host and cook Thanksgiving dinner for my family. So there's just, I just try to keep it as part of, you know, what I do. So my work feels like it matters more.
What is one of your big secrets to success?
Well, my soapbox, I'm going to jump on it and I'm going to talk about segmentation. So I think one of the things that I've been working on a lot is, you know, thinking of the CMO role as the chief market officer. And so that means that we need to be, you know, the leaders in the market have a good understanding of the market dynamic and helping our companies decide which markets we want to play in. And for me, it's always win. Like, I don't want to just play, I want to win. So how do we do that? And it's through as you called it, the 5-part alignment framework, where it really is about segmentation. And I've done this in my advisory roles and within 7 weeks at Drata, I think it was my 7th week, we did this. And it really helps to align the leadership team on what the most important segments are to focus on. Generally speaking, I'll come into an organization and there might be 5 or 6, you know, things that we're going after this segment and that segment, or we sold that customer, so let's go find more customers like them. And at Salesoft, I think it was 14. At Drata, it was about 11. Plus, they're probably new ideas. And there's nothing wrong with each one of the ideas. The wrong thing is trying to do all of them at once.
Yeah.
That's the wrong thing, right? And so here's the framework. The first thing is that you build the segments. And I'm not talking about giant TAMs. This isn't an exercise to show how big the market is. It's what part of that market do we believe we can capture to the point that we're building account lists. Like, we're in ZoomInfo, we're playing around with the characteristics, the fit, technographic, firmographic, whatever we can find to define that segment to enough where it's like, we believe that this is a viable market and these are the customers that make up 80% of that market, let's just say.
Mm-hmm.
That's, We take that number and then we do a predictive three-year value. So based on that segment, what do we think our ASP would be, and what percentage of that market do we believe that we can capture over the next 3 years? So it's kind of a longer view than just the segment itself. And that might be because one of the markets could be an existing market where we believe we can continue to capture more versus a new market where maybe we start slow and then grow fast. And so we want to make those assumptions when we're building out the different segments.
I see. And your predicted three-year value is the value if you'd captured all of them, or you're assuming like, hey, we're going to get like 5% or 10% of these.
Correct. Exactly. Like we do the true, what we think we can capture in terms of the market share, and taking into account too, like, can our company scale that fast? And, so we try to make it as realistic as possible. So we're comparing apples to apples. Again, all the options are on the table. We want to do our best to vet those options so leadership can have a discussion and decide. So we do the market sizing, that is like the true, the science work, the tangible. And then we go through a process with leadership where we look at what is a couple other factors. And the factors can change. It's not always the same thing. It depends on the company you're working with. But the things that tend to be consistent are, what is the investment needed for the go-to-market team? Does this means like sales and marketing? Is it marketing to similar people or capabilities or markets that we market today? Therefore, not a lot of incremental investment in terms of if you're going to a totally different market. So let's say you're selling to SaaS tech and you want to move into financial services. That would be a higher level investment because you don't market and the sales process is different. And generally you have to, it's better off to hire people from the financial industry who sold to financial companies before versus trying to take someone that's been selling to SaaS startups and think that they can sell to financial. It doesn't work. I've tried. I know.
Right.
So what is that go-to-market investment in terms of the skills and talent you have today? Do we have to make an incremental investment or not?
Mm-hmm. And that's step two, right?
That's step two.
Okay. So we build out the segments realistically, like at an account by account level.
Go to market team is number two.
Go to market
number
team.
Number three is product fit. And this is, a subjective discussion, but things that you would discuss in here are, are they buying other technologies like ours? Are they a technology fast adopter type of segment? Or do they need, if they're highly regulated, then maybe they do have to have specialized product capabilities, or you have to integrate with a certain technology stack, which would mean that there's product investment required on our side. Mm-hmm. So that's, again, usually it's a scale of 1 to 5 for each of these on the chart that we use. And so it's like little to no investment is a 1, high level investment is a 5. Using that financial services example again, we have there in order to make it product market fit, we have to build 3 things that are going to take our teams, 8 months to build. So that would be a medium to high level investment versus no investment at all.
I'm with you. Okay.
Product fit is the third one. The fourth one is competitive moat. Will we be able to build a competitive moat with this particular segment? Is our competitor already in the segment? Are they leading the segment? And we're never, we're trying to catch up. Is it a brand new segment that neither of us are in? So by investing here, we believe we get that first mover advantage. If we are going to go ahead and build something in the product, do we think it'll give a sustainable longer term advantage? So when you're thinking about the rating, and that one is a high rating. So if we think, hey, they're not in this market yet, we're going to build something that is unique and it's going to take them 6 months to catch up if they do a good job. So we're going to give ourselves a 12-month head start. That's a good, that would be a 5. Or that we have a unique partnership that is unique to us. And the partner has said that they will only do it with us, or they'll do it with us for 2 years and then they'll open up to the greater market. So can we find areas where we get that distinct competitive advantage that is long-term? It's not a feature. It's not a feature discussion. This is like distinct year-long competitive advantage.
So competitive advantage, a higher rating is better. So a 5 would be the best.
Correct. Yep.
Got it.
You're going for the highest number possible in the overall rating. So things that are hard or lower numbers, things that are easier or higher numbers, things that have higher impact are higher numbers.
Okay.
And the next one that I'm picking for today, and this really does have a lot to do with Drata, is partnerships. So can we develop partnerships? And that could be any kind of partnership. Is it a strategic partnership where you build specific integrations and go to market together? Technology partnerships where you have a breadth where other technology partners are building integrations to your platform, therefore making it stickier? Are they reseller or MSP or MSSP partnerships? So we can do a better job of developing those partnerships where those partners promote our products and not our competitors. So for each one of the segments, it may be a different kind of partner. So if I'm looking at a geographic expansion as a segment, so let's take our current market and SaaS startups and say, I want to do that in some of the European countries. This is one of my soapbox items too. People go, we're just going to expand into EMEA. Well, guess what? EMEA is like, 34 countries or something like that. I could be totally wrong. But it's many countries. And so I think you have to be country specific when you're talking about expansion into Europe. Because going into English first markets or English adaptable markets versus saying, hey, we're going to start in Germany because it's the toughest market to crack. And so that means we have to be localized. We have to meet their high level of regulation because it's going to make the rest of our expansion into Europe easier. That's a viable option if you want to go that route. So you just have to make, again, when you're doing your segment work, make the case. The partnerships could be different. So you might have MSSP partnerships taking you into new geographic market, where you might have a technology integration partnership, say in a financial services model.
Right. I'm with you. Okay, cool.
Are you? Okay. I'm all over the place. So that's the fifth. That's the fifth one. There are more. I think if you look at my name and account-based strategy, I've presented on this topic before with a sample. But that's it. You take those elements. I like to kind of pre-score them. And then as the leadership team, you sit and you discuss each one. And at Drata, we decided to go evaluation criteria by evaluation criteria. So we looked at the SAM for all of them and discussed it. And then we looked at go-to-market fit for all of them and discussed it and adjusted the assessment per, as we were going through to ultimately score all of the different options. We had limited it. We did research on 12. We presented, I think, 7 or 8 to leadership, which we then walked through. And then did the evaluation. It took about 2 hours, 2.5 hours for the workshop. And then you end up with your score. And that's when it doesn't matter if you pick 1, 2, and 4. It doesn't matter if you pick 2, 4, and 6. The fact is that you pick 3.
You pick 3 of them. Okay, that's what I was going to ask.
You pick 3 of them. Yeah. And I think 3, sometimes you'll see 5, but really I think 3 is always the magic number, regardless of company size. Like getting your execution teams to really fire on like strong cylinders around 3 is great. And once one of them starts going, you do the exercise again and you pick your 4th and your 5th and then you can continue to roll with it. It's something you could do at an annual basis, aligned with your strategic planning process. So that's what we did. We did it. We picked 3. And the difference of Drata versus other companies I've worked in is that Drata started implementing it the next week. Usually it's like, we put it in the plan and we start, talking and the next quarter maybe, but no, we changed things the next week. I was like, okay, here we go.
That's awesome. Yeah. And one of my favorite things that you said is that like, look, there's nothing wrong with any individual segment, but what's wrong is to do them all at once. And I think a lot of people or a lot of companies rather fall victim to that approach where they're just like trying to be too many things, too many people. Like, and you see it all the time, probably. You go to a site and they have, industries or verticals like on the nav bar and you hover over it and there's just like this huge fly out menu with like 98 different industries listed. It's like, come on, let's be specific.
Yeah. And I think it's the fear, right? Like that, of course you want to maximize your addressable market, but if you want to capture your addressable market, you have to be specific, right? You have to have that conversation with the customer. You can't, just say, we have other financial services companies and not be able to tell the story. Where you're asking your sales teams to be conversant in 10 different markets. That's really hard too, right? How do you think about specialization so we get just really good at solving that problem or the set of problems associated with that segment? That's when, and if you're doing your analysis properly, you can say, well, there's only five, we've only captured 5% of this segment. Maybe our competitors captured 5%. There's still 90%. Why are we already starting to bifurcate our strategy when there's 90% of the addressable market still right in front of us? Let's just triple down on it, go capture all of it, spend the next year, especially in this economic time where everybody's trying to become more efficient. Like, of course, focus.
That makes a ton of sense. So one quick question. So you've got this document. Is it the different segments are like in column A along the rows, and then your rating system are the different columns? Is that like generally?
So
how
rows are the segments and columns are the evaluation. Yeah.
Got it. Okay. Brilliant. That's an awesome process.
Yeah.
I love that process.
It's kind of this mishmash over the years that I've kind of continued to evolve from. If you read Geoffrey Moore Crossing the Chasm and his strategy, there's elements of that in there. And then there was a couple other companies that I worked with that did work. And time at SalesLoft, Albert Rhee, who was in running product marketing, created the actual scoring framework. Well, I was like, dude, that's great.
Yeah.
And used it. And so it's just continued to evolve. It's actually Scale Ventures. I did a template for the Scale Ventures team too. So it's out there. Someone looks for it.
Yeah. And that's the best, actually. It's like when you spend a lifetime, reading, learning, and then you just basically amalgamate them into your own thing. That's really, I think, the mark of experience. And that's a wrap. Thanks for joining us here today. For show notes and other episodes, visit us at revenuedrivencmo.com. That's revenuedrivencmo.com. And hey, exclusive for listeners of this podcast, Web Mechanics will do 10 to 20 hours of work for you for free. Literally no sales calls, no BS. Just give them a problem and they will put a team to work for you for free for 10 to 20 hours. Even if you're already a client, if you're struggling with demand gen, lead gen, SEO, SEM, Google Ads, LinkedIn Ads, conversion optimization, if you can't get Facebook or Meta Ads to work for the life of you, or you can't figure out attribution, Web Mechanics will take a good hard look at whatever problem you give them, whatever programs you put in front of them, and they will give you an objective, informed opinion, plus some advice from 10 to 20 hours of senior level attention. And that's just because you're a listener of this podcast. So I would suggest take them up on this offer. It's ridiculous. Go to revenuedrivencmo.com/free, fill out the 2-minute form, and you will not regret it. Literally zero downside, unlimited potential for growth. So do yourself a favor, revenuedrivencmo.com/free, no hyphens, no punctuations. You will be happy about that decision.